Duck, duck, goose! Duck of Minerva in stereo.
Welcome to episode 14. In this episode, Dan Nexon, that's me, interviews Michael J. Tierney, who is an associate professor of government and international relations at the College of William and Mary. There he is the director of the International Relations Program and also the director of the Institute for the Theory and Practice of International Relations. That institute produces the famous TRIP survey, which you may see every couple of years on Foreign Policy magazine, and which you have certainly seen if you're an academic in international relations, that is, cited in any number of journal articles. We will discuss that survey, as well as Mike's other work and general state of the field, coming up right now. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and I've got Mike Tierney on the line. Mike, are you there?
I am here. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks so much for agreeing to come on and do a podcast today.
I'm looking forward to it. I listen to podcasts on Duck of Minerva, so I'm happy to contribute.
So you're one of our 12 listeners. I think sometimes when we're really hot, we break 20.
So you can track each individual download?
Actually, no, I can't. And I think our listenership is at least 50 based on the feed burner stats. So I'm just being self-effacing because that's the kind of guy I am. At one point, we could track how many people were at least looking at the podcast page. But since we've moved to WordPress, we haven't installed the right tracking software to do that effectively. So I'm totally in the dark now about how many people are listening. I just have the minimum number or the sort of sense of how many people are pinging the RSS feed at any given moment. And that's been around 50 to 54 on average. So, and now we're moving. This will hopefully be on the new PodPress or PowerPress software that's running on WordPress, and it'll be easier to use and everything will be better. But that's not our subject today. Our subject for today is you. So why don't you lay down some biography on our listeners?
Biography. My dad was a Marine. I grew up all over the world. I was a tennis player. I came to William & Mary as an undergraduate to play tennis. And while I was at William & Mary, I realized I was not good enough to play on the pro tennis circuit. And so I started to take academics a little bit more seriously, starting around my junior year. I have Clay Clemens and David Dessler to thank for that. And I stayed for an extra year and did a master's at William & Mary. Back then, we had a master's in the government department. And that's when I realized I really liked this, that I could imagine staying in school for the rest of my life. And so I went and I worked 1 year in Washington. I worked for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, studying arms control verification and arms control treaties. And then I worked for the Congressional Research Service on Capitol Hill. I didn't really like Capitol Hill. And I realized I really should go back to school forever. And I've succeeded in doing that ever since. I spent a long time at UC San Diego, taking much longer than I should have to finish my PhD, but was lucky enough to get hired back at my alma mater. And I've been here for now 12 years.
So you mentioned your very long doctorate experience, and I can relate to that. I don't think I technically got my doctorate for 9 years after grad school, although it sounds like you might have me beat.
It took me 13 years, Dan.
Oh, my. But you had gainful employment for a chunk of that time, right?
I did. I was teaching at small schools in San Diego, and or then I was teaching as a visitor here at William & Mary before I finished.
Okay, well, that's pretty impressive, but it has a happy ending. So why don't you tell us a bit more about the nature of your academic work?
Okay, I think when I went to graduate school, I thought I was going to study arms control and security issues. But as you know, I went to UC San Diego. And back in those days, there was no one at UC San Diego who was studying guns and bombs and war. So, you know, as people do, you start studying the things that others are interested in that are around you. And so I started studying international political economy, international organization, and IR theory. And I wrote a dissertation on the reintegration of the former Soviet states into the international system after a Cold War. And that really ended up going along two strains. One was very international organization-oriented questions. What are the conditions under which you admit new states or transitioning states into existing international organizations? And the other question had to do with foreign assistance, right? Were we going to see a second Marshall Plan? Were we going to see some effort like we observed the U.S. engage in after the Second World War, when it came time to reintegration and rebuilding and, you know, creating liberal capitalist states, etc.? So those two empirical areas, IO and foreign assistance, are still the two areas that I pursue in my research. I've got a bunch of theoretical work on the conditions under which states will delegate to international organizations. And then once that delegation takes place, what are the problems that emerge from delegation? Can international organizations just do whatever they want? Once they've been given certain authority, can states get them to do their bidding? How does that affect international cooperation, et cetera? So that's more the theoretical IO style of research questions. And then my second empirical area is, my main area is foreign aid and international political economy, international development. So those are two sort of traditional academic pursuits that I have.
So in the first one, you have a very well-received edited volume on delegation with Cambridge. Is that correct?
That's right. I did an edited volume with Dan Nielsen, David Lake, and Darren Hawkins, which was a follow-up to a series of conferences that we ran back in the mid-1990s. That's right. So it's a terrible name. It had a great name. It was called, the name of the book was Delegation Under Anarchy. And I still remember when I found out that the name of the book had been changed. I got an email from someone who had cited the book while it was in press. And they said, "Hey, Mike, I cited your book as Delegation Under Anarchy, but the folks at the journal are telling me there is no such book, and that there is a book that you wrote called Delegation and Agency in International Organizations." And I said, "Nope, that's not our title." Well, it turns out that is your title when your publisher tells you that's your title.
You know, publishers, you know, they're supposed to know these things, but they're just awful with titling. Harry Potter and International Relations was at one point supposed to be called Broomstick Diplomacy.
Much better.
And but no, that was considered too obscure. Patrick, Civilizing the Enemy, was at one point Stopping Asia at the Elbe, which is a quote from, I believe, an American general. But no, that was too obscure. So I think at some point we need to stage a rebellion and tell these people that actually, no, we often have much better title ideas than they do.
Well, I agree with you, but we briefly fought that battle. And they came back with marketing speak. No one will know what your book is about, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, look, there's only about 1,000 people in the world who really want to read this book anyway, which is probably not the right response. And they all understand that this is playing on a much more famous book in international relations theory. And they didn't want to hear it. They said, look, people are going to search for this. They're not going to find it, et cetera. So I rolled over.
Oh, well. So then the second trajectory of your work, you say, is in foreign aid. And my understanding is that you have some really exciting news on that front.
I've been working on a foreign aid project. It's now called Aid Data. I've been working on that for about 10 years, and it's very empirically oriented, unlike the work on IOs. It's sort of built around very large database, a project-level database. That project actually started as a student-faculty research project back in 2003. I had a student named Brad Parks who was trying to figure out, in his honors thesis, he was trying to figure out what are the impacts of bilateral foreign aid on the international environment. And I had just written a little bit with Dan Nielsen on reform at the World Bank and multilateral aid and its impact on the environment. So it was a natural fit for us to work together on his honors thesis, but it was frankly the best honors thesis I've ever seen here at William & Mary or anywhere else. And we told him at the end of the defense he needed to turn it into a book. And he said, I'll only do it as a book if you guys write the book with me. So it was Brad and I writing with an economist named Rob Hicks and a sociologist named Timmons Roberts. And we wrote a book called Greening Aid. But in order to write the book, we needed to build a bigger, stronger, faster, better database. And that's what led to Aid Data. And so we did write the book. We told Brad, this book will write itself. And we'll be done with a draft after the summer of 2003. Well, as you know, books don't write themselves. So it actually ended up getting published in 2008. But the reason it took so long was we realized the data that everyone was using to write their articles in development economics and in IR was flawed in some very important ways. And so we created a larger database that was more complete and had much more information about each individual project. And as you might expect, more information about what the likely impact of the project would be on the natural environment. So as we were finishing that book project, which was just purely academic, it was sort of principal agent theory goes to foreign aid. But as we were finishing that project, started to get phone calls from folks at the World Bank and the Gates Foundation, and they wanted to know whether our database could be used to either improve aid coordination or to enhance aid transparency. And so they were more interested in much broader audiences and greater accessibility to this database. We were thinking about sort of putting the database online at the University of Michigan and saying, you know, economists and political scientists who want to use these data can. And they were interested in making sure that beneficiaries in Kenya, in the villages that were receiving the foreign aid, could also access data and see what had been promised to them. And so that developing country governments could use the database to do better planning. And so the journalists in the United States could use the database in order to, you know, hold the US government accountable or whatever. So they had this transparency agenda that got quite interesting. This was my sort of first foray into the real world of IR. And I learned an enormous amount. But the outcome of all this, or the most recent outcome of all this, was back in around 2010, Mike Finley, who was at BYU and he's now at University of Texas, Mike Finley was doing some work using our data where he was trying to identify the subnational geographic location of every aid project. And it was extremely difficult to get enough information about the aid projects in existing databases or in existing documents to get good subnational location data. But we realized that Mike was really onto something. He was interested in the relationship between foreign aid location and civil conflict. And so he developed this really useful methodology for geocoding aid locations, which has subsequently been adopted by the International Aid Transparency Initiative, which is sort of this budding international regime for aid transparency. But anyway, in the summer of 2010, we really started working hard on this geocoding work. And quite recently, the U.S. Agency for International Development has decided to enter a cooperative agreement with Aid Data to gather more and better geospatial data on aid and then do research and mash that data up with other subnational data in order to help them and to help other donor organizations to do better aid targeting and better planning. So for years, you can go and look in econ literature and you can read these big statistical models, these big papers that show that aid doesn't always flow to countries or doesn't always flow to locations within countries that are the most impoverished. But knowing that and seeing a regression result is one thing. Seeing that exact same information displayed on a map has very different impacts in the policy world. So when folks at the World Bank that we were working with in 2010 and 2011 saw that, it really penetrated much more effectively than any article you might write in a journal like World Development. So anyway, we've just entered into this cooperative agreement with USAID to work on gathering better geospatial data at the subnational level and then also doing research and analysis in a number of different areas that USAID really prioritizes.
Well, that's really great. And does that mean that you'll be traveling to places? How exactly are you going to get better geospatial data?
Yeah, that's a great question. So far, we have two different methods for getting better geospatial data. In the summer of 2010, we worked with the World Bank. And the World Bank, as you know, has incredibly detailed reporting requirements to their executive board and these very thick project documents that actually have a lot of location data. So you can get right down to the long lat coordinates, location data from where the money is going. But of course, it's in these 300 page documents. So we have students using these large project documents and sort of going through the hundreds and hundreds of pages to find all the locations where aid money actually went. And so for that, you don't need to necessarily go anywhere. You can do that if you think your documents are reasonably accurate. You can do that from the top down. So if a donor organization has really good documentation, you can find ways for humans or for computers to look through the text in order to figure out where the locations are. But as you might guess, most donor organizations don't have documentation like that. So really, we think the best way to get subnational location data is from the bottom up. And so in 2011, the University of Texas had a research project. It was led by Kate Weaver at the University of Texas. She took a bunch of her students to the finance ministry in Malawi and worked for about 5 or 6 weeks in Malawi. And that way she was able not just to geolocate all of the World Bank flows going to Malawi, she could geolocate all flows going to Malawi that the government knew about. So if the US government was giving money or France was giving money or even China was giving money, she could use their what's called an aid management platform. She could use the government's aid management platform and work with staff there so that her students could work from the bottom up. And we found this to be a much more refined and accurate approach to figuring out where all the aid is flowing inside of countries. So we're going to use both methods.
How much has this kind of local data been exploited in terms of efficacy studies? I mean, I know one of the things that has happened in the peacekeeping literature over the last few years is a move from countrywide data to, where are the blue helmets or the non-blue helmet peacekeepers hanging out. Is the development literature already pretty advanced in terms of actually using the unit of analysis being geographical locations where aid is going in, or is that something that this project will really allow to happen?
Right. No, it's right now the state of research in development, that would do what we're proposing is extremely underdeveloped because frankly, no one has these data. What you have in development is from the top down, you've got a lot of development economists who for the last 30 years have been doing cross national time series analysis, where the dependent variable is usually economic growth or it's poverty rates or something. And they conclude things like, look, we put all the aid flows on one side of the equation and we controlled for a bunch of things and we look at a dependent variable like growth or poverty and they conclude, aid has no impact on poverty or aid has no impact on growth or vice versa. Right? There are all these debates in the aid literature about that. So that's one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, you have people doing very detailed case-specific analyses of one or three projects in Tanzania. It's story time in Tanzania, but it's very difficult to generalize from those three projects at any given point in time. And so the meso approach, I think what we really need to do is do sector level studies where we refine the cross national time series. And instead of having the dependent variable be economic growth or poverty in a country, you have the dependent variable should be number of kids going to school. And the independent variable should not be all aid, it should be aid for education, right? And so that's one meso step that we're sort of taking and others are taking, especially at the Center for Global Development. And then in terms of geolocations, no one has done really good work that is certainly not over time of the subnational location of aid and its impacts on any dependent variable, whether it's terrorism, conflict, economic growth, inequality, right? I mean, I just think the field is wide open. People are just waiting for decent data, and then they know what they'll do with the data. So if you tell people who study comparative politics that we're going to collect and then provide access to these data, they get very excited, probably more excited than the sort of international relations people do.
Well, I can see why there was so much interest in funding this project, and it sounds like you'll have a lot to do with some serious resources.
Yeah, finally, it's going to be resourced at a level that I think that will allow us to collect the quality of data that we would like to collect. So we're right at the beginning of that. I guess we'll know in a couple of years whether or not we've done some good.
Now, it's funny, you know, the time horizons on big data collection projects are so long, and it's not something that I do, that, you know, I guess one really has to have a lot of patience if one is collecting the data and then turning around and eventually using it rather than just, you know, using a prefab data set or using data that doesn't really require, you know, this level of investigation.
I think that's exactly right. And, you know, if you think about it from a professional point of view, it, you know, it presents some real problems. So I've been spending a huge amount of time over the last 10 years collecting and making data accessible, right? This is not, it's a collective good, but this is not something that you build a career around. You know, what you ought to be doing is writing more and better papers than you were in the past. So it's a problem. So really, I think the people that should be doing this kind of work are people that are happy in their current institutional setting and that who have tenure. And so they can afford to spend a little bit more time providing collective goods. But yeah, it's not, you know, there is definitely a trade-off between sort of creating large data sets versus actually writing papers. The last 3 or 4 years have not been very productive for me, in part because I'm mostly collecting data rather than using it. So I can't wait for that to stop.
Well, this gets into larger issues that we probably don't have time to deal with about how exactly we measure productivity and our laser-like focus, particularly on article publications, and how that might be negatively impacting the quality of scholarship. But let's not go there, although we'll hit some related topics soon. Before we move on to, I think, one of the things that has made you most famous in the academic community, as opposed to the policy community, I did have to ask about this new edited volume that you have coming out at some point, being revised for resubmission, The Politics of International Organizations, Bridging the Rationalist-Constructivist Divide.
Well, you're very optimistic when you say coming out. This is a project that I started with Kate Weaver about 10 years ago. And we were both really interested in the project. To make a long story short, Kate was working on the World Bank. She was interested in reform at the World Bank and World Bank behavior. I was interested in exactly the same two topics. And Kate got a rough draft of a paper that I had written sometime, you know, 2001, 2002. And I was coming at this from a very rational choice, principal agent point of view. Kate, on the other hand, was a Mike Barnett student. She was sort of steeped in sociological approaches to organizational culture. And she read this paper that I had written, and she wrote back the most detailed comments I've ever received on a paper in my academic career. She wrote back line by line suggestions about what I ought, you know, here's some documents you ought to look at. By the way, what you've said here about what happened in 1998 is totally wrong. This is what happened. You should call me, et cetera. And so she just gave me wonderful comments. And then she said, and I've just written a paper myself. What do you think? Here's some chapters of my dissertation or something. And I returned the favor. And this got us to thinking that our theoretical frameworks that we had chosen had understandably caused us to see certain things and to not see other things. And that talking with someone like Kate, who was a real expert on the bank, really opened my eyes to a lot of factors that I was underplaying in my analysis. And this got us thinking, what would it be like if we could pair a rational choice person with a constructivist person who studied IOs what would it be like if we could do that across a variety of different issue areas? Kate and I were sort of thrilled with our own productive exchange, and we thought everyone would love to do this, wouldn't they? And so we assembled a bunch of scholars from both sides of the rationalist-constructivist divide and had a couple of conferences and wrote papers, sent out a manuscript to a bunch of different publishers, and they sent us back great comments, revise and resubmit. And then basically, I think what happened was life took over. Kate got interested in finishing her book on the World Bank, and I got interested in the Aid Data Project and in the TRIP Project. And we've just never really, you know, it's a project that's 90% complete, and we've never really sort of sat down and spent the 2 or 3 months we'd need to spend cracking the whip on our authors to get it out the door. So I don't know when it's going to come out, but I'm still really interested in the issues we raised in the volume, and I think it should see the light of day, but I don't know when exactly that's going to happen.
Well, that gives me some feeling of not being... I've been feeling terrible because we've been having this relationalism volume sit around for, you know, I guess maybe 6 or 7 years now. But maybe I shouldn't feel so bad that there are other...
Get to 10 years, Dan.
You're beating me on all these metrics of slothfulness. I don't know how I'm ever going to recover my sense of self. I wanted to ask you about TRIPS, which is, as I alluded to earlier, probably the thing that's made you the most famous in the academic community. And, you know, just as this is going to sound incredibly cheesy, but just as your global development data is going to transform the way we do global development, I think the TRIPS data has really transformed the way that we think about the field, or at least made us much more rigorous in the way we talk about the field. So could you tell us a little bit about what TRIPS is and how it came about?
Well, I will, but only if I can then ask you a follow-up question, which is, how do you think it's transformed the field? Because I'm somewhat skeptical of that claim, but I'm really interested in that claim. The first person to say that to me was Alex Wendt, and he was actually extremely nervous about the way that he thought this would constitute the field and sort of change what we were doing. I think he was nervous, very nervous about the impact that it might have. I'm not certain I see big changes, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that if I'm allowed to turn the questions around.
We're allowed to do anything you want. In fact, one of the things that's been a little bit, well, I mean, since I've turned to doing more interviews because Patrick's busy being like an admin and stuff, you know, there's been less kind of dialogue on the podcast. So if we can open it up in this one, that's great. So anyway, you need to give us some background because not everybody will know what TRIPS is. And then we can kind of go into the sort of discussion of its implications and impact.
Sure. So the short version is in the summer of 2003, I had a research assistant named James Long, and he was helping me with my research on international organizations. And we were out at a bar one night. He said, "Hey, Mike, how come you teach international relations, intro IR, from such a realist perspective?" So the single question that you ask in the course is, why does war occur? And then you follow through an expanded Waltzian framework of the three levels of analysis. But the question is always about war, and whether or not the answer is realism, whatever the answer is, it has to respond to realism. Why so much realism in war when you're not a realist and you don't even study war? And I blathered something about, well, you have to learn to walk before you can run, and this is the way they teach physics. You do Newtonian physics before you do relativity. But that was just a lie. I didn't know. I hadn't sort of thought about why I taught it that way. In retrospect, it was probably because the best teacher that I ever had was a guy named Phil Roeder at UC San Diego, and that's how he taught the course. So I taught it that way. But it got us to thinking, does everybody else do this? Or do most people teach something closer to what they do research on? And is realism still central in most courses in international relations? And so this series of conversations in the summer with one of my students led to the crazy idea that what we ought to do is systematically, we ought to ask international relations scholars about the status of realism. And of course, once you've decided you're going to ask a bunch of people a question, the easiest thing in the world to do is for somebody to say, "Hey, if we're going to ask them about X, why don't we ask them about Y and Z too? And so that basically led to a very large survey of all international relations scholars in the United States in 2004, where we asked them, and you are one of the respondents, or at least you're one of the people who receives the survey, we asked about 80 questions. It was a crazy survey with way too many questions. It probably takes 30 to 45 minutes to complete in that first year. But, you know, we had all these questions that we thought people would be interested in the answers. And so, to make a long story short, we've now done the survey in 2004, 2006, 2008, and 2011. And we expanded it from the United States to Canada in 2006, to 10 English-speaking countries in 2008, and to 20 countries speaking six different languages in 2011. So one big component of the TRIP project is surveying IR scholars and asking them questions about their teaching, their research, their views on the discipline, and their views on foreign policy. The second major component, which I actually think will be the more important component of the TRIP project, is to track what is being published in the top journals in international relations. So we took the top 12 journals that publish IR articles from 1980 until 2011, and we code each article individually, where the article is the unit of analysis. We code each article for about 28 different variables, you know, paradigm, methods, region, time period, you know, so all the things you might think you might be interested in. And I really think that as a way of sort of tracking changes in disciplinary norms and changes in what counts as knowledge in the international relations discipline, I think the journal article database in some ways will end up being more important than the surveys, which are also really fun.
I actually agree with that, and I'm curious when we're going to get access to this wonderful data you've been collecting.
That's a good question. You know, if we had gotten our act together back in the early, mid-2000s and gotten the National Science Foundation grant, that problem would have taken care of itself. Because when you get an externally funded project, one of the conditions is usually you need to make the data available to everyone else. This is a project that has largely been funded out of internal resources here at William & Mary and out of blood, sweat, and tears from Sue Peterson, Mike Tierney, Dan Maliniak, and Ryan Powers. We have gotten two small grants from the Carnegie Corporation, but right now we're seeking more funding. Anyway, independent of the funding question, this spring we're hosting a final data vetting workshop here in Williamsburg. And then I expect by probably 2013, early 2014, we fully intend to make the data available to everyone. We're building a website that not only allows stats geeks to download STATA files or CSV files, we're creating software that will allow people that aren't very technically savvy, will be able to interact with the data online. So you can do simple searches within the website to get, you know, the statistics that you want, the descriptive statistics that you want. So that's our goal. Whether we get external funding or not, we are going to make all these data public in probably late 2013, early 2014.
Well, I certainly do appreciate how much work this is. I mean, I just, you know, this is the relate to your own work moment that I've been doing probably too much of. But, you know, I started a project about a year and a half ago to try to track uses of Thule's state formation work because I figured I had an intuition about how it had been used, and I wanted to demonstrate that intuition was right. And I got some undergrads to do it, and it's just been going extremely slowly because even for a single set of citations, it's just a lot of work to code those articles.
Oh, it is punishing. I feel for your students, but if they weren't there doing that, you know, if you don't have them all rowing in the same direction, there are certain kinds of projects you just can't do. I've twice talked to really smart people who do this sort of, they use computer algorithms to try to read the text. We've twice tried to get computers to code the article for us. And there are some things they can code well, but mostly, if you're trying to sort of understand is Nexon giving a positive or a negative citation to Mearsheimer in this article? Or is Nexon taking this Mearsheimer article seriously, or is it, you know, he's sort of merely sort of mentioning it and moving on? It turns out you need human beings to understand the context of the debates in order to understand the meaning of the citations and the meaning of the arguments. So I'm all for mechanizing things that can be mechanized, but at the end of the day, there's just no substitute for really smart, hardworking, focused undergraduates who, you know, can help you in these kind of projects.
So you asked me earlier, you said you wanted to flip the question back onto me about significance, so I think I'm going to try to get us to talk a little bit about the impact TRIPSIS have. One thing that obviously comes to mind is the Review of International Political Economy Forum, right, on differences between North American, or specifically United States-based, international political economy. International political economy as it's practiced outside of the United States, and there the sort of mounting evidence that was talked about in that survey about, or in that forum, about how sort of the open economy approach and then a set of methodological tools has really become dominant in American international political economy in a way that it hasn't so much elsewhere, and that's created a real kind of transatlantic divide. Although, you know, I don't think you want to oversell that. There are plenty of people and a growing number of people doing quantitative work in Europe, and there are some fairly influential sort of constructivist qualitative IPE types are interested in, you know, identities and in ideas and the constitution of interest and stuff like that. But that's a forum that I think, you know, really grabbed a huge amount of attention because it hit on something that people sort of were saying was going on but weren't really entirely sure about it. How did that come about?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it was 2008. It was 2008, something like that. David Legge, Judy Goldstein, and, you know, four or five other people put together a new academic organization that was, it's really, I think, based on the Peace Science Society. The idea was, we don't just want to go to APSA, we don't just want to go to ISA. We want to get folks that are doing work that is similar to ours and have a smaller regular conference, and they call it the International Political Economy Society, IPES.
Yeah, I remember I used to get, I got in the early days solicitations to join it, and I thought either, you know, they've bought a mailing list,
right,
or they're more Catholic than I would expect. But anyway, go on.
Well, that's not, but your point was very well taken. That's exactly what led to this. So in the very first meeting of the IPES, which is held at Princeton, they invited a couple of big moose heads to come and describe the state of the discipline of IPE. And so they had, I think they had Bob Cohane, and then they had Jerry Cohen and somebody else. And basically the argument was, Cohane's argument was, look, the big questions that we used to ask in IPE are no longer being asked anymore. And this society, the IPES, is reflective of that, right? This is a narrower group of scholars who are all working within a positivist epistemology, largely quantitative methodology. In that first year, I'd say 90% of the papers were quantitative. And there was a little bit of formal modeling thrown in, but not much. It was mostly quantitative IPE. And he was sort of lamenting the fact that IPE was, from his point of view, was getting narrower. And then Jerry Cohen said, it's not that way everywhere. In Great Britain, you know, they have a different style. And in fact, these folks that used to talk to each other are moving further and further apart. So at the time that we were having this inaugural conference and this conversation, Dan Maliniak and I, who were at this meeting, we had actual data. So Jerry Cohen was telling stories about, you know, all these old great IPE people that he knew in Great Britain. He was telling Susan Strange stories, and he was saying,
yes, when dinosaurs ruled the earth.
Exactly. How great Nye and Cohen and Katzenstein were, and how we all talked together, et cetera, et cetera. And I looked at Dan, and Dan said, you know, these are really interesting claims. They might be right, they might be wrong, but we could figure it out. Like, we could actually bring systematic evidence to bear on this. And that was the first idea for the... at least that was Dan, my first idea with Dan, and he said, look, the very next year we're going to present a paper on this at this meeting, which is what we did, and Jerry was there for that too, and then we sort of took the show on the road, and we went over to the UK, and we went to the BISA in England, and we presented similar arguments, and Jerry was again arguing for bridge building, and we were describing the fact that yes, if you're going to talk, you better build a bridge. And then it quickly turned into, you know, some people wanting to say, well, our side of the ocean is better and we like it this way, and other people saying, no, our side is better. So there seemed to be very few people who were actually somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic. And so, yeah, anyway, that's where it came from. I think it's really interesting stuff. I learned a ton by talking to IPE scholars in the UK. And yeah, they really do speak a different language than we do.
Well, you know, it's hard to be in the middle of the Atlantic. It's cold and wet.
You get seasick.
Exactly. But so that was an example of a forum where I think you're right, sort of the having some kind of data, whatever its limitations, really kind of advanced the nature of the discussion, or at least held out the option of doing so, even though people quickly move to the normative, I think, in these discussions. I mean, this came up, I don't know if you remember when Patrick and I were kind of pinging you mercilessly a few months ago, because we were working on this piece, which may never appear in a forum on, the end of international relations theory. And we had a set of kind of working hypotheses about why we were even asking this question, let alone, you know, whether or not IR theory was coming to an end in any meaningful sense. And our first inclination was we got to go to you because you're likely to have some data. And I think I raise that particular example because I think one of the great services is we just have a lot of folk wisdom in the field. Yes. About its history, about where it is now. That folk wisdom is not consistent across discursive communities or discourse communities. It's nice to actually start to kind of try to test this. I mean, one of the big examples I would give you that I don't know what the data on this says, but I suspect that the survey data is consistent with the story I'm about to tell you, which is that, you know, for a long time, we talk about the dominance of realism. And I was interviewing Nick Onuf at ISA Northeast last weekend, and I got the real sense that there really was a period in which even if realism didn't necessarily dominate published work, the realists, that is the individuals who are realists, really did kind of exercise a lot of control over the field.
Uh-huh.
But that argument about realist dominance sort of persisted into the 1990s when to younger scholars like myself, who were younger in the 1990s, it seemed fairly clear that, you know, it had to be the case that most of these citations to sort of seminal realists were critical citations or drive-by citations, right? That really it was hard to identify a lot of people who were practicing, living, dyed-in-the-wool writing articles from a explicitly realist perspective. So there's something where, you know, the data, and there was data collected on this. I mean, there was the Power Politics project and its various iterations, and some papers that I saw in those iterations presented in the 90s did suggest that, you know, an increasing number of these citations were actually critical in character. It's the kind of thing where, you know, you have one set of folk stories, you have another set of folk stories, and we have no real way to adjudicate them without getting this kind of information.
Dan, I couldn't agree more. I want to say a couple things about what you said. First of all, you are much more perceptive than I was in the 90s. I still believed what I read in my introductory textbooks, and I taught that to my students. And when I wrote articles, I framed them. I asked myself, what would realists say? How would a realist respond to my account? It was a dominant sort of overarching framework that I just felt we, as IR scholars, we always need to respond to the realists. You said it was already, the writing was already on the wall, and you saw these, you know, the fading of realism. I did not see that. And so the biggest shock to me when I looked at, and by the way, I will say this, most of your colleagues in the IR field were more like me than they were like you. So when you compare the number of publications that are realist in orientation to the perception of the number of publications that are realist, like if you ask people a survey question that says, what percentage of the field is realist, they dramatically overestimated, as did I. I could not agree more that you know, sometimes facts are useful to know. The second thing I want to talk about is, you know, you mentioned that there are these folk stories. And when I, you know, so the what is the wisdom at the ISA bar? And I used to talk about those folk stories as if they were universal. Everyone at ISA says XYZ. Well, as you correctly pointed out, there are different folk stories for different communities. And depending on who you're sitting with at the ISA bar, you get them speaking as if something is completely obvious. I mean, they totally believe what they're saying, and they believe everyone else believes it, and they're just wrong, right? They're only in their own little world. So as this relates directly to Trip, I will tell you, most of the hostility that we have generated, most people are very nice. They're like, hey, thanks for doing this. This is really interesting. But some people are not appreciative. Most of the hostility comes from two types of scholarly communities. One is what you might call the sort of hardcore rationalist, game theoretic, modern political science-y IR scholars, right? Without naming names, these are the folks that say, I can't believe you're even asking people about paradigms. Why are you asking about realism, liberalism, and constructivism? That is so 1990s. Nobody talks about that in any PhD programs anymore. We don't teach that. It is entirely irrelevant to the way we do our research, right? It's passé, right? And you guys continuing to talk about this, exacerbates this myth that the IR field is organized by paradigms. So that's one set of people that we get. And they say, look, you're not asking the right questions, which would show how much more prominent our approach is now, right? You don't even have categories that we fit into. You need to change your questions, or you need to change your coding scheme for your journal article coding, right? So they're very, they're upset because in part, I think they agree with Alex Wendt. In part, they think this is one way in which the field gets constituted. If people start looking to a source that has quantitative measures over time of certain things, that people will defer to that authority source more than others.
And that is a real risk, I think. So
maybe. I have no idea if that's true. I'm actually skeptical. But they think something's at stake mm-hmm. here. Secondly, so
that's where I have a lot of, I have more difficulty. But anyway, go on.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you about that. Like, they really think something's at stake. And I said, no, this is my hobby. Like, we're doing a research project. It's one of many different efforts to sort of characterize the field of IR. But the second group of people who are equally or more hostile are what you might call postmodern, post-structural, feminist. I don't want to paint with too broad a brush.
Well, Trevor Barnes has this wonderful word, which is post-prefixed social theory. So
those are the people I'm talking about, right? And some of them, you know, quite smart. But the story is very similar to the story you get from these sort of rational choice, post-paradigmatic people, which is, hey, you guys are not even asking I can't even fill out your survey. The categories you're asking me to put myself into, I can't do that. I'm much more complex and interesting than your survey can possibly capture. You need to add 27 more values of this variable. And I'm like, okay, well, welcome to survey research. But, you know, it's not to denigrate either of these two groups. It's to say that I do think Sue and I and Dan and Ryan started with this, you know, sort of assumption that there were these established concepts that we talk about to our students, that we talk about in our research, and that we talk about when we go to the ISA meeting, and we ought to ask people about that. Does asking about particular categories, you know, sort of highlight those categories and make them sort of promote them in real life, you know, as constructivists might argue? Maybe, but I really don't know any other way of going about this. What we have been, and you know this because you've been a recipient of these emails, we have been extremely open to people from all sides of the divide to say, listen, if you will write a question that's not a completely stupid question, we will ask it. And so you've seen, especially in 2008 and 2011, there were a lot more questions that, you know, if you were paying attention, you'd go, well, this clearly wasn't written by Sue Peterson. This was clearly written by somebody in, you know, some far off land or somebody outside the mainstream of international relations. And, I don't know if, how much we're going to learn from that, but we're certainly open to the idea that we ought to ask questions in different ways or have research experiments built into the survey to try to learn things about what people really mean. I'm quite open to that. So anyway, that was a long way of saying I think your observations are very perceptive. But I still have the same question I started with for you, which was, please do now, let's hear the argument. Let's, whether you believe it or not, and tell us whether you believe it, let's hear the argument about how the process of us doing this research will constitute the field in some particular way and make us think about the field in certain categories that, you know, may be good or bad.
Well, I mean, I think that, I would rest my argument not so much on, you know, a major reconstitution of the field, right? I don't think that, you know, but on changing the way that we talk about the field, okay. I think is a more accurate way of saying it. And primarily by that, I meant supplanting, or at least providing us with a set of data, however flawed, that isn't just a recapitulation of the folk wisdom, right? And so in the most recent survey, for example, there were a couple of things that really stood out at me, right? One of which was, you know, the one that everybody remarked upon, that the most common paradigm turned out to be constructivism, right? And the most common category turned out to be, you know, non-paradigmatic other, right?
Right.
And I think that the fact that non-paradigmatic or other, the sort of catch-all category, was the most common didn't surprise me, because I think that's actually where the field's been headed for quite some time. It's, I mean, nobody's even allowed to defend the paradigms anymore, right? I mean, it's so the field, whether or not, you know, it's a good thing or not, the battlefield's been so conceded that, you know, I think you could count on the number, could count on one hand the number of people who are willing to stand up and stake out an identity and then defend the idea that the paradigm should organize the field. So, but I think, you know, in that sense, it provided an interesting kind of confirmation that something like that is really kind of percolated, right? Secondly, the fact that constructivism did so well, I think is an indication of how much the field has changed. Right. And maybe a wake up call to people who still do self-identify or see their research as constructivist to stop feeling like they're under assault. Right. That they're a kind of embattled minority. So those were two of the things that I found interesting. But even more interesting, I thought, was the who is doing the most interesting work now category. And I don't just say that because when you actually see all the data, I actually did okay on it. but you know, you, for part of this thing we were looking on, you did let us see, you know, the complete list. And I have to say, it's just an indication of how fragmented the field is.
Exactly.
Right. I mean, I can't remember the precise numbers, but, you know, like 100 through 500 on that list is, you know, three people mentioned you.
Right.
The next 30 or so, you know, you maybe got eight people, right? You get pretty high with, you know, 25, 30 people out of the survey mentioning you. And right. To me, that is an indication that we don't really have a shared discipline anymore, which was something that I thought was the case, right? But here is some pretty stark evidence that that we don't have the kind of opinion leaders or superstars, as you will, that are kind of transnationally and trans sub-field viable in the way that we might have, or at least our legends say that we did in the 80s or 90s, right? We don't have the Cohen's, the Katzensteins, the Krasners, et cetera.
Right. Dan, a couple of points. I think these are really good observations, and I would say we have an ability to test to see whether we've become more fragmented over time, at least between 2004 and 2011, which is not a very long time. Mm-hmm. But I find your hypothesis very plausible. So point number one is, when you ask people who has had the biggest influence on the field, you do see that there are still people near the top that are getting very large percentages of the votes.
Exactly.
That you're getting, there is agreement across the subfields over which people have had the largest influence. When you ask people who's done the best research, you also get larger agreements, I mean, relatively large percentages. It's only when you ask who's doing the most interesting research, and I think this is, it makes sense that we're all interested in very different things, it makes sense that the absolute numbers are going to be much lower. To test your hypothesis, what we would need to do is to see what is the ratio, what is basically the fragmentation ratio in 2004, when we did ask those same two questions, and 2011. Mm-hmm. And your hypothesis, if we're becoming more fragmented, the numbers should get lower and lower and lower, and more people should be listed on the most interesting over time. And I have never looked at that, but I would guess that you're probably right. I mean, my sense in my own career, I am definitely, maybe this is just true as you get older, this is what you do. But I started out, when I left graduate school, when I would go to APSA or ISA, I always went to the very biggest panels and I wanted to see the big moose heads and I wanted to hear what they were going to tell me about the IR discipline and what we ought to be thinking about. As I've gotten older, I end up in much smaller and smaller groups talking to people about very specialized things. So I don't know if is this a normal thing to do? As you get older, you become more specialized, or is it the opposite? It's certainly what I've done. Is this characteristic of the field, or is it, sort of where you are in your career? Do you have any other evidence? Like, forget the survey evidence for a minute. What else would you point to say, I think there used to be a single set of questions or a series of questions that sort of held us together as a sub-discipline of IR, and now we don't really have that. Like the IPE Society, for one, or the PEIO Society, two things I belong to, they're fairly narrow, and they allow us to get on with the process of talking to people who are doing research like us, but that means I'm not going to meetings where I'm talking to people like you.
Well, I do have to be careful because I did put this in a more or less category, and I think that I would rest on that the field is just quite fragmented.
Yes, I would agree with that.
But I do think that, so I have a set of, pet hypotheses that it would be nice to be able to test, right? Involving this, right? I mean, one is we've had this tremendous growth in journals.
That's true.
And anecdotally, what I hear talking to some of the same people I talked to 10 years ago or 15 years ago is that the big, what I call the certification journals, like IO and World Politics, those are not being consumed as avidly by people in my extended circle as they would have been 10 or 15 years ago.
That's also true of me, Dan, and I have a very different extended circle.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
And I actually feel kind of comfortable with that because my circle is somewhat interstitial, right? I think I've done a reasonable job of trying to cultivate ties across some of the field's domain. So there's that. I think some of that is probably an impact of just the proliferation of journals, right? We just have so many of them. The barriers to startup have gotten so low that there's an intention conservation problem.
Right.
And I also think you're right. There's been a creation of more and more specialized groupings. But I also think that you're right about the event panels at ISA and at APSA. Because I certainly remember going to event panels in the late 90s and seeing the faces of very senior people and mid-career people in the audience.
Yep.
In a way that I don't see them now on the few occasions when I do attend the very few event panels that there are. And part of this miss, and what's if the coding of the dependent variable, as it were, is correct, there it does lead to a set of questions about the causation. For example, does the growth of journals matter? Does the internationalization of the field matter, right? The fact that it's that you have, countries that now have the resources to support things like international relations departments at their universities, and you have just raw numbers that are much larger, right? There are a whole bunch of different things that could be going on. And this podcast will come out after my interview with Nick, and Nick himself stressed very much the globalization of the field as something that was contributing to its fragmentation. Some of the stories that he told about, say, the coup d'etat at IO in the late 60s, early 70s, I can't quite remember, reminded me that there are fewer kind of centralized levers of power to get control of now than there might have been once upon a time, if these folk stories are true.
Right.
I don't know. So there, I get a sense that it's more fragmented. I get a sense that we are engaged in very much a kind of, at least in the United States, in a kind of normal science approach, particularly in the kind of late Kuhnian sense, you know, not the sort of Kuhn we're familiar with paradigms, but the stuff that Kuhn was working on before he died, where he talked about speciation is what happens to sciences, right? Where you get sort of subcommunities and specializations, and then translation becomes difficult across those specializations. And that, to him, was a kind of necessary cost of progress. And maybe that's what we're going through now. I don't know.
Right. No, that fits with my intuition as well. I did just think of one other way to test your hypothesis, and I know who's doing it. Dan Maleniak and Ryan Powers have three different papers now using network analysis.
Yes, that's what I was going to say, doing network accounts of citations and also of hiring practices.
Yeah, well, if they're doing these citation analyses, and they can look over time whether or not the citation networks per article and per journal are narrower, right? If it was true, if the Mike and Dan thesis is correct, then it used to be that IO articles would cite much more broadly. And now each individual article ought to be citing much more narrowly. And so they can pick this up, like, you know, they have measures of this. And so, you know, I'm guessing you're going to be right. And what you're going to see is greater fragmentation. I mean, just as a reviewer, as I review these articles now, so often I'm looking at the list of citations and I say, oh, okay, so I know which group this is coming from. They're not citing anyone from over here. And these guys aren't citing anyone from over here. That's much more common now to me than it was 10 years ago. But
you see, it's interesting because here, this is something which actually, if you think it's a problem, and I do think it's a problem, right? I think that the failure to kind of cite outside of your silo indicates a kind of a risk of the pathologies of monoculture. Right? Intellectual monoculture. This is something that editors can do something about. If you edit, and I've actually put this in editorial bid pitches, but, you know, that hasn't worked out so well so far. You know, if you edit a kind of, a journal that's supposed to cover the entire discipline as an editor in the conditional accept stage, you can say, you know, one of the things we want you to do is broaden the appeal of your article by thinking about X, Y, and Z literatures that do bear on your question, but that, you know, don't show up, right? There's also, of course, the fact that word limits on articles are getting restricted, and that the first place that gets cut are the citations, right? Whenever we go to make our...
Oh, yeah, that's right. That is what I do. You're right.
So there are ways in which it may not be that there are sort of inexorable secular trends that are inexorable secular trends that are contributing to this perception of fragmentation. It may be that there are some, you know, kind of very, there are some institutional mechanisms, that are creating or reinforcing it that are in fact manipulable. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that seems very plausible to me. Yeah.
So, but I mean, one of the things that I think what it's done is it's gotten us to, you know, at the very least, I think it's gotten us to think more systematically about the field, and it's given us, Tripp has given us something to look at if we want to, you know, do a kind of gut check on some of the kinds of claims that we make. And I think that's really a useful service. I think it really has entered the discussion. I think it's become virtually impossible to write a kind of, now I'm going to talk and genuflect about the field without at least going to the Tripp survey. Before you could just bloviate without any kind of data. And I think Tripp has made that harder to do. And I do think that the people who are concerned about its constitutive effects, you know, they have a point. But part of me sort of reacts to that by saying, you know, one of the problems with the survey is that the change in questions make it more difficult to do intertemporal comparison.
That is true. We have this fight. You can imagine what this looks like, Dan. We have this fight every year among the PIs. We're going to do another survey. There is value in terms of time series analysis to keeping the questions identical. But there are two things that, you know, push in the opposite direction. One is you wrote a crappy question last time, and what you're really trying to get at would be better measured if you asked the question slightly differently. So that's one problem. And the second is, you might want to learn something different. You might say, well, we know the answer to that in 2006. Now space is very limited. So we want to learn something different, so we're going to change the question a little bit.
No, that's fine. I mean, what I was actually going to lead up to, I understand completely why you all do this. And, you know, as you've said, I've actually been in on a couple of the questions about discussions about question formulation, is that, you know, if you really don't like the survey, maybe you should write your own.
Yeah. Well, people are doing that more now. I get surveys. Do you get surveys about the IR field other than this one now?
I haven't gotten a single survey specifically about the IR field. I've gotten surveys about citation practices, and I've gotten surveys about, you know, data usage and stuff, but I've never gotten another IR survey, which...
What about the one, didn't you get that one from ISA that I think Matt Baum and Kathleen Hancock, they were asking you about career choices?
Oh yeah, I did see
remember that one? Yeah.
But that was sort of, you know, what I mean is a sort of a kind of pulse of the discipline.
Okay.
Rather than, you know, I've gotten surveys. A lot of them are about professional questions, but those are the kinds of surveys you expect to get from associations, right?
Right.
You know, in a sense, you know, wouldn't it be interesting to go out there and do a survey that asks different category questions and, you know, as another set of data points? And, well, I don't want to denigrate at all the enormous blood, sweat, and tears that, you all put into this, but at some level, it's not that hard to do a SurveyMonkey survey.
Right? No, it's not. You're
and
absolutely
if,
right.
And if you're not going to put, and if you have a very specific purpose, you know, I want to try what happens if I have different categories for how scholars affiliate or describe their work, you know, you could probably do that, right? And, you know, at least, you know, and put in some reasonable care, you could probably do that. You know, it might take you a month to think it really through and to vet it and to put it up there if you weren't trying to do something as comprehensive as what you do. So I, to some degree, if people are upset with you for having a negative constitutive effect on the field, it strikes me the obvious answer is to try to do it better, right?
Well, that was my response to Alex when he was a discussant. And I think he made the correct point. This wasn't about the survey. This was about the journal article database. But he made the correct point. He said, well, I think the results that you have here for these top 12 journals would be very different if you also included the next 12 journals. And then sort of waved his hand around and said, so you guys should go do that. Mm-hmm. And so I have two responses. One is, I think you're right because I know what the next 12 journals are. And they tend to be systematically different in their theoretical and methodological orientations than the top 12.
But that is a heck of a lot of work.
On average. And that's my second question. It's like, okay, big guy, let me introduce you to something called empirical research. Go right ahead and code the next 12. That would be an enormous amount of work. But I do think you're right. I think what he is suggesting we would see is a different picture and frankly, a more complete picture. So I would... I'd love it if somebody would take up the same methodology and start adding other journals. Jason Sharman and Kate Weaver have a pilot project now where they have added books. Kate has always suspected, I think quite rightly.
I think I've talked or at least emailed with Kate about this. But
okay, yeah. I mean, she thinks that articles, especially because they're shorter by nature, but because they're getting shorter and because certain people at the top of the discipline in mainstream IR control these journals, she thinks that certain kinds of theoretical research and certain kinds of methodological work gets, the bar is higher. And so she expected to see more constructivism, more postmodernism, and more qualitative research in books, and that's what she found.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Me neither, but it's one thing for you and I to say that at the ISA bar, mm-hmm. and say, oh, I know, the constructivists, they write more books. But it's another thing for Kate to show what is the size of the gap? What are the differences? And that, to me, is a real contribution that she and Jason have made. I don't know if that's published yet. I know they had a working paper floating around for a while, but it should come out soon.
Yeah, I mean, we should, obviously, we'll have some chance to talk more about the survey itself. Because one of the things that's occurring to me now that I would really like to see you guys start asking questions about is cumulative research, right? You know, things that people think are established facts.
Well, Dan, I will say to you what I've said to you in the past. Mm-hmm. Honestly, if you send me a question, mm-hmm. Not only will we consider putting it on, we'll, you know, go back and forth and figure out what is the right way to ask the question to get at what you want to get at. Because mm-hmm. I think you're right. That's a good idea.
Because one of the things that the network work that I've seen on citation patterns has been showing, which I think we should be disturbed by, is how much of, you know, first of all, not surprisingly, how much of citation patterns are a click structure, right? Or a click embedded in a kind of broader core periphery structure, right? Where you have a set of people who are reinforcing the citation counts of one another's work. And that's what everybody tries to do working in a research program. It's just some people have succeeded and some people haven't. But also that, you know, that's led to the second order question for me, which is how much of, you know, the sense that something is an established fact is a consequence of click patterns of citation, and how much of it is actually, you know, we have good reason and rough consensus that something is in fact an established fact. And one of the areas where that seems to be happening is the democratic peace theory, for example.
Right. So, no, I can imagine that question now. Can you please write it and send me a draft and we'll start iterating on that?
Sure, I will do that. So Alex's concern was that you were reinforcing a particular kind of core of the field in the journal citation work, if I understand you correctly.
No. He was concerned that he had two thoughts. He said, one, if you're claiming that your data represents the IR discipline, you should be more self-conscious and you should be more upfront about the fact that your data really only represents the top 12 journals as, you know, ranked by the Social Science Citation Index. That the field is rich and varied, and Millennium is not in there, and Global Governance is not in there, and books are not in there, et cetera, et cetera. And, I think that's fair enough. So I think that was one of his points, which was, you know, you have a sampling problem, mm-hmm. his point of view. Fair enough. So his second point was, once you've decided that you're gonna, you've got your sample, you're gonna move on, the questions that you ask and the language that you use and the terms that you use and the categories you provide to people or the categories that you provide to your coders are going to impart, highlight and reify certain ideas and certain concepts at the expense of others. And to that I say, yes, that is true. That is what happens when you do research. And so this is the way we did it. We're very open and honest and transparent about the way the data was constructed. Here's the code book. But you're right. That's what happens. So if you think social constitution is incredibly important, then you're going to, you know, you should care a lot about what categories are on surveys and in code books. Yeah. See, he's a smart guy.
So what kind of so you've been doing this for a bit now. I'm curious what kinds of findings, if any, have really surprised you?
Well, the two that jump out to me are, and I, you know, when I saw this result in, I think it was 2007. Yeah, it was late 2007, early 2008. We had just gotten through about 2,000 articles. So we had a very large sample across 12 different journals and across, you know, it wasn't biased in terms of time. We had equal amounts over time. It was, you know, a decent sample. To see the level, the percentage of articles in the literature that directly employ a realist framework in their work, you know, ranged between 9% and 14% over a 30-year period, that shocked me for a couple of reasons. One, I thought realism was a much larger part of our published discourse in terms of the raw number of articles published. And two, I had read Vasquez's book, The Power of Power Politics. And, you know, when they're doing their descriptive statistics, it's 40, 50, 60% of articles. Granted, we measure them differently, right? He includes the dependent variable. We don't. We think the causal variables are the things you should measure when you're saying, what is this person's framework they're employing? But still, it was just this massive gap. And I said, this is wrong. I looked at the readout of the descriptive statistics and I said, we must be a column off. This has got to be some other paradigm, and this is not realism. It's just way, way too low because it plays such a prominent role in our conventional wisdom and in the stories that we tell each other and our students. This must be wrong. And we went back and we not only checked to see that these data were correct, we resampled and we recoded. And I made sure I was coding and Sue Peterson and Dan Maliniak were coding. And it's not wrong. So that's the first finding. Now, the caveat on the first finding is it is true that realist articles are more likely to be cited than any other type of article in terms of the paradigms. So it is still important in that respect. Realism is taken more seriously by others outside of realism than any other paradigm is. But that was just striking. That continues to shock me. And it's clearly surprising to most people we survey, because I have data when we ask people what percentage of the literature was realist in orientation in the 80s, in the 90s, in the 2000s, presently. And everyone always overestimates realism. I expect that if Wendt is right, and this research we're doing actually matters and actually has an impact on the way people think, then the gap should shrink as people learn, oh, look, it's not as prominent. But I haven't really seen that yet. So that was a shocking finding. The other one that shocked me, I suppose we always knew that academics in general, IR scholars in particular, would tend to agree that there would be an epistemic consensus on certain policy issues. But the degree of the consensus on some policy issues is pretty shocking. It was always very surprising to me. So the two that stand out to me are basically there's just an overwhelming majority of people who study international relations who believe that the Iraq War was, you know, you can put this in a lot of different ways because we've asked the question in a lot of different ways, but the Iraq War was bad for U.S. security. It was bad for international security. It was not supported. 87, 88, 89% of IR scholars were opposed to the Iraq War or thought it would hurt U.S. national security. We always sort of knew there would be, you know, it would be higher than the general public, but that is incredibly tight consensus. So that's one. And the other is really free trade. Whether you're a realist or a Marxist or a constructivist or a liberal, IR scholars believe that free trade agreements like NAFTA and the WTO are beneficial for the states that are engaged in them and that are members of them. I thought we'd see a lot more variation based on political ideology, based on paradigm, based on a lot of different factors we can control for. But there is just an amazing consensus on those. And so those, I guess the size of those gaps are sort of two things that surprised me, Dan.
Well, it's both pretty interesting stuff. I mean, I guess the kind of strong Vasquez response to the realism claim would be that while it may not be that self-identified realists using realist variables are dominant, that certain realist assumptions are kind of baked into work such that, power politics models do in fact exercise a kind of stealth hegemony. I don't know.
That's the claim. I guess without getting into the details, I guess I would say in 10 minutes, you can figure this out and figure out where you stand on this. All you have to do is go back and look at their coding rule for what constitutes realism. Like, what are the assumptions? What are the things they're looking for? And so some of the things are on the independent variable side. There are things that you would expect, you know, is the state a rational unitary actor, you know, making any assumptions at all about what the interests of the state are, what is it pursuing, et cetera, et cetera. Fair enough. We're on the same page there. Then they also say if the person is trying to explain war or outcomes of war, you know, it goes on and on with these three.
Yeah, then it's realist.
And you're looking at that going, wait a minute, that's not realist. What if you had a liberal or a constructivist theory of war, but you were explaining it based on the identities of the actors or, you know, you see where I'm going. And so I think that's why those numbers are so high. But, you know, you can look at that, you know, and make up your own mind, I suppose.
Yeah, I think one of the problems, I think I should, you know, let you go soon. But it strikes me that one of the problems with trying to code for the new categories, right, is that one of the things about the 1990s, and I won't speak to the period before then, although I suspect that there were similarities, at least on some counts, is that we had kind of well-articulated dominant movements, realism, liberalism and constructivism, although liberalism itself was, I think, morphing much more than people realized in the 90s.
Yes.
And so you had, you know, you kind of could make reference to them. And now the claim is that we're post-paradigmatic. You know, we've gone from what I've called the paradigm war to the war on paradigms.
Yep.
And yet, there clearly are, if you think about it hard enough, paradigms out there, right? And we've tried to come up with labels for them, not always successfully. Certainly there is a kind of, I don't know if paradigm is the right word, and I've actually argued in print against using paradigm for this sort of thing. There is a cluster of research that centers around a very spare set of often called rationalist mechanisms, right?
Yes.
Comes out of particularly Fearon's work on audience costs and veto players. And, you know, it's not just Fearon's work, but Fearon, you know, really kind of blew the lid off of some of this stuff. You know, a set of kind of you know, so there's that kind of work. But people who practice that kind of work tend to see that as non-paradigmatic, right? Because they tend to say we're doing inferential work, and then we can sort of show that that particular mechanism looks like it's happening, right?
Yes, that is exactly what they say, Dan.
Yeah, and but to outsiders, it looks like a kind of it sort of, if you'll excuse me, swims and quacks a bit like things we used to call paradigms. Then also kind of within the people who would have once called themselves constructivists or been affiliated by others with the constructivist movement, there's a lot of heterogeneity. And that heterogeneity is now much more perceptible than anything unifying about it. So I'm not sure what those people would call themselves. And so on and so forth. So it's not necessarily that we don't have quote-unquote paradigms, or that even the paradigms we have now aren't clear descendants of the paradigms that we had in the 90s. It's just that people really don't like that language for various ideological reasons, either because we're doing science now and we don't want to have to argue with realists anymore, or because constructivism is that bad American via media and we're doing something much more radical and interesting, or what have you, right? And I don't know. I mean, it might be that, you know, the problem... This is a huge problem for survey research, but it might be interesting to kind of try to come up with some of this stuff inductively or inferentially, right?
I don't disagree with anything you said about the state of the field and things people say. Mm-hmm. It's not clear to me what follows from that in terms of how to proceed inductively or inferentially.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm all ears. I'd be happy to carry on in this conversation. I'd be remiss if I didn't point out something. We've been talking for a little over an hour, and I would say 50% of our conversation has revolved around paradigms in some way, the paradigms in IR. We've been sort of skirting around or talking directly about that for almost half the time. This happens a lot when I talk to people about the TRIP project. Some of them are quite happy about this, and some are quite bent out of shape about it, but it happens a lot. I just want to point out that paradigm is one of 28 variables in the journal article database. And I think we ask probably 2 to 3 questions about paradigm on a survey that has between 80 and 90 questions on it. So this is not a criticism of me or you, but sort of at some meta level, maybe it says something about our discourse in IR that we do keep coming back to it, whether we like it or not.
Well, I think
there's a war on paradigms or a paradigm war.
Well, you know, we don't have good ways of organizing the field, and we all like to organize what we do. So maybe it's that. Well, I think it's a fantastic survey, and maybe we should have talked more about the kind of who's doing the most interesting work or who's done the most influential work, or some of the questions about teaching, where I think you still see a lot of sort of canonical. There's indications that we're still kind of moving from canonical texts, or at least teaching derivative work from canonical texts. One of the questions, and maybe we should leave on this one, is, so one of the criticisms that I've heard advanced about the survey is that the number of respondents who are better characterized as comparativist, right, is quite large. And that this might have impacts on the answers to a lot of the questions. Is that right?
It is true that the way that we collect, I should say just a little bit about the way we collect the sample to explain why it is true that a lot of the people that are initially surveyed are better characterized as comparativists. If I had to put a number on it, I'd say something like somewhere between 15 and 25% of people probably self-identify as comparativists. And we send those people the survey. Now, that percentage may not answer the survey, but... Okay, so the reason that is because back in 2004, when we decided how we were going to do our sample frame, we decided that we wanted to survey everyone that taught international relations or did research on international relations, broadly construed. So, for example, if you are an expert on, let's say, Belgian domestic politics, but you also sometimes do research on Belgian foreign policy, or you teach a course on European integration, we wanted to get your answers because we felt like your answers were part of what contributed to the IR disciplinary discourse in the journals, if you're writing on European integration, but also because we wanted to know what students are being taught about international relations. And while Belgian foreign policy is rather obscure, the basic idea was we wanted them in rather than out. So if I had to guess, I'd say the total number is somewhere between, right around 20% are people who would primarily identify as comparativists, but happen to teach or do research on things IR sometimes. I mean, that's A. But then B, what I would say on the flip side of that is, as a scholar who wants to analyze the data, I mean, there's a simple solution here, right? If all you're doing is looking at the top lines, here's the descriptive statistics of everyone that took the survey, right? Then, yeah, you're getting a bunch of comparativist answers in there. But it's a simple enough solution from a survey researcher's point of view, which is you go in to the question about what is your primary subfield in political science. We ask another question about how would you characterize your research expertise. We ask like three of these questions, and you can select your sample however you want. So if you want to cut out the guys who teach an occasional course on Belgian foreign policy, you can eliminate them from the survey. You can eliminate people who teach at liberal arts colleges. You can eliminate men. You can cut your sample up any way you want and say, aha, for real IR scholars, the way I define IR, look at how different the answers are. That makes sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So
all these data, Dan, you can chop this up any way you want.
Well, I know it's an exciting prospect. So I usually end by asking people what's next, but I think you've already told us a great deal about what's next. So I'll just thank you for spending so much time talking about your work in the field and exciting practice ends of what you're doing. And I hope that we can talk again sometime.
Thank you, Dan, and keep the podcasts coming. I like listening to them in the car, even though my daughter doesn't like it when we turn on.
Oh, you've just put a huge burden on me because now I've made your daughter miserable. I also have to keep clearly the swearing to a minimum. So, All right.
I appreciate that.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye, Dan.
Bye. Well, folks, you've come to the end of another Duck of Minerva podcast. This one was recorded November 6, 2012, which means the earliest you could possibly be hearing it is almost a month after I initially interviewed Mike. Oh well, hope you enjoyed it. Bye-bye.